It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. It's coming up later, the case that we make too many judgments based on our read of a person's face.
First, we're continuing our series of congressional candidate forums here on Central Time. Yesterday, we heard from both candidates running for the state's second congressional district seat.
We also heard from Ron Gritt, the Democratic challenger in the race for the state's 8th congressional district seat. We now turn to his opponent in that race, who's seeking another term as the representative in northeastern Wisconsin. Reed Ribble is a former small business owner and the Republican congressman representing the state's 8th congressional district. He joins us now by phone. Congressman Ribble, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, to start, why are you running for another term in Congress?
Well, I think there's still some work to be done. The reason I ran in the first place was to the degree that I could affect change as it relates to the nation's deficit spending and the direction our economy was headed. I wanted to do that, and there's still more work to be done there. The economy can still grow. Some of the obstacles that have been put in place by government to allow our economy to grow are still in place. There's been progress made on the deficit for sure, but I want to continue to complete that work.
When people think of Congress, they'll think often of gridlock, political bickering. There are low approval ratings for the institution as a whole. Make the case that you can help bridge those gaps and get some things done.
No, I think their perception is based in reality. Certainly, there's a level of gridlock because there's differences in opinions between the two chambers of the Congress. The House and Senate have not been effective in working together. Right now, there are over 300-plus pieces of legislation that have been passed by the United States House of Representatives that have not been voted on by Senate Democrats. And so I think the American people will ultimately make a determination as to whether or not who's responsible for that. However, I think when I went there, I was struck by the fact that it seemed very difficult for me as a Republican to reach across the aisle and find willing members to work with. But through a little bit of diligence, through taking some folks out to dinner, to setting up meetings, I was able to start a group with Congressman Kurt Schrader from Oregon, who's a Democrat from Oregon, called the Problem Solvers Caucus. We started with four of us, and by the end of this term, we'll have over 100 of us meeting together. We try to grow it equally between Democrats and Republicans. So if you're a Republican and you want to join our caucus, you have to bring a Democrat colleague. If you're a Democrat, you have to bring a Republican colleague with you. And those meetings have been extraordinarily beneficial to building trust and understanding for the two political ideologies that are there.
Before we move on to particular issues, looking back in your first years in Congress, what are you most proud of? What, in hindsight, do you think you could have done differently?
Yeah, you know, I think for the fact that as far as what I'm most proud of, I think it's the completion of the highway bill. When you look at what had happened in the prior years, it was extension after extension after extension. And we were finally able to get MAP 21, the current highway bill, passed into law. It was a two-year bill that solidified America's infrastructure. And it changed how we go about infrastructure projects. There was a lot of streamlining that took place in that piece of legislation. 95 pages of the streamlining was my own language that came out of my office. And we reduced the construction time and project time from an average of 15 years down to 7, and that has is significant savings in the billions of dollars for American taxpayers. And the increased work that can be done for those dollars is really significant. So I would say that that's one of the highlights of the time that I've been in Congress as far as big accomplishments. And then things that I would like to have seen done different, we still have an ongoing entitlement crisis, in my opinion. By 2032, the actuaries are telling us Social Security will be insolvent around the same time or just shorter than that. Medicare goes insolvent. The Social Security Disability Trust Fund goes insolvent in roughly 14 or 15 months. And the Congress has not been able to act on those. And so that's troubling to me that we've not been able to fix those.
Well, let's follow up on that. What would you like to see happen with Social Security to extend its lifespan
even
further?
Yeah, you know, well, ultimately, I think you have to take a look at it. Since every single American participates in the program, every single American should participate in its reform. And while some people say, well, we should just raise the amount of tax subject the amount of income subject to the tax. Well, that's a good idea, and that gets you about 30% of the way there, but it ends up being a 30% solution for a 100% problem, and it's often divided by political lines. Democrats will often say, well, just raise the tax. Republicans will say, well, Americans need to work longer, or we need to change the cost of living adjustment and all those things. In reality, it's probably going to take a combination of all those things to get to a 100% solution for a 100% problem. And what that will do by spreading the cost across all 300 million Americans, hardly anybody has to bear a lot more burden, but all of us bear a little more burden so that my 8- and 10-year-old grandchildren are secure in knowing that Social Security will be for them as well as current seniors. And so we take care of current seniors and future seniors by getting at a big reform that covers all those bases.
Well, when we're talking about elections, whether here in Wisconsin or nationwide, jobs and the economy loom large. Let's start with job creation. What role do you think Congress could and should play in boosting job creation here in the state and around the country?
Yeah, well, certainly I think anything that we do nationally will affect Wisconsin ultimately. And so I look at the barriers or the friction points that are put in place by government that slow the economy down. And they're centered around things like tort policy, regulation policy, taxation policy. It would be one thing if our corporate tax rates were competitive inside this hemisphere, much less globally, and we're not competitive in either place. And so if we would get serious about fixing our transportation infrastructure, changing tort in this country, getting at trade agreements, making sure that taxation is fair and competitive globally, and having a regulatory regime that actually has a fair and level playing field for both large and small companies, I think we could make a lot of progress on economic growth, and the economy would actually just really expand very aggressively.
When it comes to tax reform, a lot of people argue that, well, we may have this higher level of corporate taxation than many of our neighbors in this hemisphere, as you say, but who actually pays that? Does it balance out when you check out the loopholes and deductions that are available?
Yeah, well, you have to remember that most corporate taxes are paid by individuals who have passed through companies. About 90% of America's businesses are held in either limited liability corporations or in subchapter S corporations, where the entire corporate profit gets passed on to the shareholders, which are, by the way, relatively few people for each company. And then those individuals must pay the corporate tax rate, which, by the way, right now is around 44% if they're at the maximum rate. And so it doesn't get passed out around equally. Large multinational corporations are typically paying somewhere in the 27 to 33%, the maximum rate at 35%. But if we compare that to what the Canadians are doing just to our north, one of our primary competitors in this hemisphere, they're at 15%. So no matter how you structure your corporation in the U.S., you're not even remotely close to what the Canadians are doing.
So it's going to be a big, messy piece of legislation to change that. Do you see a prospect for bipartisan cooperation between a Republican House and Democratic Senate or Republican Congress and Democratic President?
I think it's more likely that it could happen if it's a Republican Congress than a Democrat Senate. I think that our best opportunity to get it to getting to legitimate tax reform, where one side or one political party isn't jamming down the throats of the other party their particular ideology or ideas, in a divided government where the Congress is controlled by one party and the White House controlled by the other, seems to be the best operating model. And in fact, the last time real tax reform happened was under President Reagan, when the dynamic was reversed. You had a Democrat Congress and a Republican president, and they were able to find a point of compromise. And President Obama has sent out several olive branches in relationship to the tax code that he'd like to see, things that Republicans agree with. I believe that we might be able to have an opportunity. There's a very good chance that Congressman Paul Ryan from Wisconsin will become the next chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, which writes tax policy for the House of Representatives, and Wisconsin will be at the forefront of drafting that policy.
We're talking right now with Republican Congressman Reid Ribble. He's up for re-election in Wisconsin's 8th congressional district seat, and he faces Democrat Ron Gritt in next week's election. If you've got a question for Congressman Ribble or wondering where he stands on a particular issue, you can call now at 800-642-1110. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Right now, we're hosting a candidate forum with Congressman Reid Ribble. He's the Republican incumbent candidate running for Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District seat. If you've got a question for him or you want to hear his thoughts on an issue, you can give a call right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org. We'll go to the phones now. We've got William on the line in Oconomowoc. William, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? My question would be, he talking about giving all these corporations such tax breaks. What about the middle-class citizen who's paying most of the taxes? And if I remember correctly, Romney taxes was half of what my taxes is right now. I just want him to comment on that.
Thanks for the call, William. Congressman Ribble, middle-class personal income taxes versus upper-class.
Yeah. That's a fair question to be asked. One of the basic key points that he brings up here is the disparity in the tax code whereby investment income, in particular capital gains income, is taxed at a different rate than regular income or earned income. And so as a result of that, a higher affluent wage earner can end up having a much lower tax rate. Now, I don't know exactly where policy is going to reside as it comes to individual tax rates, but I think at the end of the day, if you can get that top marginal rate down low enough, let's say maybe capped at around 25% rather than 35%, you would then be able to take all income and treat it actually the same. And because right now capital gains can be taxed at around 15 to 17%. And so we've got a tax code that says to Americans that if you're working to make it in America, you pay a higher rate. If you've made it in America, you pay a lower rate. And I think what you want to do is take that manipulation out of the tax code and simplify it so that no matter where that income comes from, it's treated the same under tax policy. That way, those who are trying to actually make it in America are not treated unfairly, as what the caller just alluded to. As it relates to corporate taxes, I'm not advocating some big corporate tax giveaway. I am cognizant, however, that corporate taxation is paid by somebody, and it's typically paid either by customers if the marketplace will allow prices to go up, or it's paid by labor. And this is one of the big fallacies in understanding tax policy and how businesses work, is that they say, well, you're just giving a big tax break to businesses. Well, not really. There's a compression of middle-class wages in this country right now, in part due to high corporate tax rates. And so if corporations cannot move within the marketplace to move pricing up to offset the tax burden, then they capture that pricing by compressing wages. And we're seeing that play out in real time right now.
Moving to a related issue, the federal budget deficit, our annual deficits have gone down some in recent years. The debt overall, though, continues to grow up. Your thoughts on fixing that?
Yeah, as long as we have deficit spending, the debt's going to continue to go up. People always ask me and challenge me to cut waste, fraud, and abuse, and I'm all for it. But one of the biggest wasteful things that we have is the $260 billion we're paying in interest on the national debt right now. And so we have to get to a place where we can get to structural balance, whereby revenues align itself with how much money we're actually spending on the way out. It's difficult to get to, though, because members of Congress have their hands tied by law. And by that I mean all entitlement programs, which would include Social Security, Medicare, veterans benefits, things like that, are protected by written law and cannot be touched without changing the underlying law. So you actually have to reform the program to bring those into balance. And other things that would be required or mandatory spending would also be interest on the national debt. That's about 65% of all federal spending, so the Congress only has control of about 35% of spending. And as more and more Americans age and go into retirement, this problem gets exacerbated over time. And so we're going to have to continue to modify those things that are causing a slowdown in the economy to increase economic growth. I talked about that a moment ago. And when you do that, more revenue comes into the Treasury, driving that deficit down.
Moving on to health care, the House of Representatives, Republicans in the House have voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act a number of times. That didn't get through the Senate, wouldn't get through the White House. Would you like to see the Affordable Care Act repealed, or are there specific changes you'd like to see, accepting that it might be here for a while anyway?
Well, I'm a realist as it comes to the Affordable Care Act, in that as long as President Obama's in the White House, a full-blown repeal is not likely to happen, because he's going to veto any repeal, and there's not going to be the numbers to override a veto. And I've been an advocate here in the last couple of years of providing reforms inside the Affordable Care Act. I couldn't care less if it's called the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, or whatever, as long as we get at the core issues that are driving health care costs up. And here in Wisconsin, it has a lot to do with availability of supply of health care. One of the fallacies of the Affordable Care Act is it made the claim that it is equal to have access to insurance is equal to having access to care. And having access to insurance is irrelevant if there are not enough doctors to provide the services in various places around the state of Wisconsin. I represent the northeast part of Wisconsin. It's a very rural district that is underserved by health care providers. And there isn't adequate providers in many places in northeast Wisconsin and all of northern Wisconsin. And so now we're requiring people to pay for an insurance product, but they might have to wait months to get actual care because there's not enough supply. Where we should have been directing our efforts was on inducing more students to go into healthcare, to increase the number of primary care doctors, increase the number of nurses, so that the supply of healthcare would go up and get in balance with the ever-increasing demand here in this country. As long as those are out of balance, you're going to continue to see prices go up. So any discussion that we have as it relates to healthcare in this country must first look at the issue of supply and demand. It's the only way you're going to get control over it.
Moving to immigration, both houses of Congress have passed their own versions of some kind of immigration laws. Nothing has come out of that, though. What would you like to see happen on immigration?
Yeah, I've said right from the very beginning, back in 2009 when I first decided to run for Congress, that it's very difficult, and it was proven back in 2005, 2006, to pass a comprehensive immigration bill. The larger the text of that bill, when you get into 2,000, 2,500 pages, it is so complex that buried inside that text are always going to be poison pills for members of the House. And so, therefore, you should do this sequentially, taking the individual titles of the Senate bill, writing them from a House version of it. So the Title I is on border security. The House should pass its own border security bill. It should pass its own version of the DREAM Act. It should pass its own version of what highly skilled immigration reform should be and immigration reform for low-skilled workers. Pass them sequentially, because you will get 218 votes for each element of it, but they won't be the same 218 members. And then over the course of time, you would get to a full comprehensive solution that actually can get to the president's desk.
But the worry from Democrats, I think, is that if you have an a la carte approach, Republicans in the House will say, sure, quick vote on border security. And then the reform stuff, the path to citizenship angle maybe doesn't get passed.
Well, they can take that posture. But how has their posture worked so far? They've got the same conflict with the House Republicans saying we're not going to take up a full-blown comprehensive bill. What they're going to have to do is figure out how to compromise with us and move something so that you can get to step two. What I hear from most House Republicans is that if we can get a border that's secure and we feel comfortable with those security measures, they're much more open to doing the rest of the package, because then we know that what has gone on since 1986 or 85, when the last immigration reform bill was passed, won't be repeatable. And so you have to have the border security and interior enforcement mechanisms in play to get Republicans to vote for those other elements. If you do that, I'm very confident that that'll happen.
In just a few moments, ISIS remains probably the top foreign policy priority right now. What are your thoughts briefly on airstrikes and possible ground troops in the future there from the U.S.?
Right now, the strategy by the commander has been to go strictly with airstrikes in support of the Free Syrian Army, the Iraqi Defense Forces, and the Kurdish Defense Forces. As time goes on here over the next several months, we're going to see if that strategy is going to be effective in stopping ISIS. Initially, they were under the idea that if we shut off all the supply lines through airstrikes, in other words, if they cannot resupply with new weapons, new arms, and food, then we could, in essence, starve out ISIS inside Iraq. But they've not been successful in doing that because there's too much free movement at night and in areas that you can't fully cover. So will it end up with troops on the ground? I can't say at this point, but it would not surprise me if at some point the president doesn't come to the Congress and ask for additional authorization to do so, at least with special forces.
Congressman Ribble, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was good to be with you. Thank you.
That was Republican Congressman Reed Ribble up for re-election in Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. His opponent is Democrat Ron Gritt. We talked to him yesterday on the program. You can check out all of our candidate forums over at wisconsinvote.org. New research on facial structure shows that we think we can tell a lot about someone's competence and leadership just by looking at their face. But in fact, we're generally pretty erratic and wrong about our assumptions.
Why does this matter? Because people with certain kinds of faces get more votes, better jobs, and promotions in real life, while other people get more guilty verdicts and blame. Christopher Olivola joins us now. He's assistant professor of marketing at Carnegie Mellon University. Christopher, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. How's it going? Welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Now, what kinds of faces get the most love from society?
Well, you know, that depends critically on what it is that you're trying to achieve, what your role is. When it comes to politics, I think that looking competent seems to benefit, people who'd like to be successful candidates, right? Those who'd like to attract more votes. When it comes to being like a CEO of a company, competence obviously is important, or looking competent. Actual competence obviously is important, but looking competent helps. Looking dominant can help. When it comes to the military, there's research showing that those who look more dominant tend to achieve higher ranks. So that seems important there. But of course, you know, in other domains, looking dominant or competent might not be the most important thing. And you might imagine domains like, in the context of maybe, let's say, online dating or something, where looking maybe more warm and approachable would be more important. So it kind of depends on the situation. But for something like competence, usually that's usually something that benefits the person, looking competent.
Now, are we right when we look at someone's face and say, hey, that person looks really competent, or that person looks very warm, or that person looks dominant? Are we right by looking at a face? Do the qualities match the looks?
We certainly think we are, and we certainly like to think we are. But the research, as we see it, the evidence doesn't suggest that we're particularly good at it. This is a tough question to answer because, you know, a lot of research will say, well, you know, if there's an agreement between what we think of other people and how they see themselves, but that's not exactly a good measure, right? So if you know, I might think I'm an intelligent person and want other people to think it, and I might have an intelligent-looking face, but that doesn't mean I'm actually intelligent, right? So what we've tried to do is look at things that we can measure objectively. So, for example, one thing might be a person's political affiliation. Are you a Democrat or Republican? Can people tell that from a person's face? Our research and other research suggests people are slightly better than chance, but not much. And in fact, if you make it harder for people by taking out things like gender, ethnicity, and age. So imagine, for example, an election between all middle-aged Caucasian males. Actually, that doesn't take much of a stretch, right? And what you get is people become much worse at figuring out which of these two middle-aged white guys is the Republican or the Democrat. There, the accuracy drops to about 51%, where 50% would be chance. We're really not that good. It's also the problem is when we're focused on appearances, we're ignoring other better sources of information, right? So it kind of distracts us from more useful information. So I would say all in all, it's not a good idea to rely on appearances. We're not that good at it. We're pretty bad at it.
Didn't you find that people tend to vote for the person who looks the most Republican?
We do, but interestingly, this is only the case in, as you might imagine, it's only the case in areas or states or among voters who themselves tend to be more right-leaning, right? So in states where people tend to vote for the Republican presidential candidates, you do see this relationship. Candidates who look more sort of stereotypically Republican, and I mean they have faces that make them look stereotypically Republicans, they tend to get more votes, all else being equal. That doesn't mean, you know, they're necessarily going to win the election, but it seems to give them a boost. In fact, this is a case even if the candidate happens to actually be a Democrat, which is surprising, right? Because when you go to vote, the ballot tells you who's the Republican, who's the Democrat. Now, of course, the question, what is a Republican-looking face like?
Mm-hmm.
We're not entirely sure. We just have, you know, we show people pictures of the two rival candidates, and we have them guess which one is the Republican candidate. And the percentage of people who say that a particular candidate is the Republican, even if that person is actually a Democrat, that correlates, that predicts that person's vote share. Now, what's interesting is in left-leaning states or among left-leaning voters, we don't see this relationship. Left-leaning voters don't seem to be, influenced by this what we call political facial stereotypes. But I should say, we're not saying that sort of Republicans or right-leaning voters have this kind of superficial bias. When it comes to something like looking competent, there we see both Democrats and Republicans are more likely to vote for competent-looking politicians, regardless of actual competence. So in this particular case of looking Republican versus Democrat, for some reason that we're not entirely sure, right-leaning voters seem to be swayed by that. Left-leaning voters, not so much, although left-leaning voters are certainly swayed by other facial features.
So people think they know what a Republican looks like, even if they may not actually know what a Republican looks like, and that's the person they're going to pick?
That's the person they're going to lean towards, right? And so, assuming they want to vote Republican, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so if looking Republican is going to be helpful in a mainly, you know, conservative or right leaning, area. If you're running in a conservative or right leaning state, it's not going to be helpful. On the contrary, it's not going to help or harm you. Actually, is what we're finding in a left leaning area. So if you're running in an area where, you know, where most of the voters are right leaning, it can help boost votes if you look more Republican, especially than your rival. But at the end of the day, of course, voters are not just voting based on appearances; they're also voting on other things like a person's actual party affiliation. But we are finding, though, that it does sway them to some extent, even if they, you know, even if ultimately the Republican candidate wins. So let's say the Democratic candidate looks more like Republicans; they're probably not going to win, but they're going to lose by less if the more they look Republican, even if they're actually the Democrat, if that makes sense.
It gets complicated, doesn't it? Right. Well, there's some pictures that I've seen that sort of exhibit your the way that a face might look competent, for example, and it looks as though the person on the non-competent side, it looks like an introverted face. It's someone who's a little more withdrawn and sullen, and these are drawings. The person in the middle has more of a neutral expression, and the competent, supposedly looking person looks really bright-eyed and eager and enthusiastic, even in this sort of resting face, which sort of looks to me like another word for competent would be extroverted. So is there a bias here toward people who are extroverts?
I think that in many domains there certainly is a bias towards more extroverted persons. I can imagine that being especially the case in politics. Maybe even, you know, when you're selecting a CEO for a company, you might lean towards the person who looks really outgoing. I should say, though, that while there are similarities, as you point out, between a sort of what most people consider to be a stereotypically competent-looking face and what they consider to be a stereotypically extroverted face, there's some differences, right? So the extroverted face looks a little bit kind of happy and even more bright-eyed. The competent face looks decently happy, decently bright-eyed, but there's also this kind of serious look to it, right, that you wouldn't get with an extroverted face, right? So there's some relationship between them, but there's also some ways in which there's a conflict between looking really confident and looking really kind of outgoing, but maybe, you know, not necessarily very serious.
Well, you're worried about what you call facism, that we think we know something about someone based on their face, but it's really hard to stop, I guess, judging books by their cover if we've been doing it our entire lives and are used to guiding ourselves a little bit by intuition. What do you think people should do to get out of that mold of what you call facism?
That's a great question, and we're certainly worried about it, and we think everyone should be worried about it in general, right? I mean, our results and the results of many other researchers are showing that, as we've been discussing, you know, looking a certain way seems to benefit people, and then looking another way seems to harm them, and that's not good, right? I don't think we want to live in a society where people are succeeding or failing because of the way they happen to look, or worse yet, from our own point of view, we're selecting leaders based on these superficial things. But you're right; it's a tough thing to sort of tackle. Part of the reason is because we're so just used to you know, processing faces, right? I mean, the human brain is really good at this, and we do it all the time. And we I think, you know, we have this tendency to think we can really read into people. But there may be, you know, our research and the research of others suggests that there are some ways around it. And one way, for example, is to educate people. There's some really great work coming out of from political scientists at Berkeley MIT showing that this relationship we're talking about, the more competent-looking politicians get more votes. It turns out that's mostly true among voters who are low in political knowledge. So voters who have relatively low knowledge about the sort of ongoing campaigns and the candidates, and also voters especially who have a lot of exposure to the candidates on television, they're the ones who seem to show the strongest relationship between how competent the candidates look and their likelihood of voting. But voters with high political knowledge, the sort of voters who really keep up, let's say, on the news, the politics, what the candidates are about, they're much less affected. In fact, they're almost not at all affected by what the candidates look like. So the good news is there are some, at least in the domain of politics, for example, one solution is to make sure voters are educated and can keep up on the issues. We obviously can't make sure they don't see the candidates. That's impossible. But we can try to educate them, or at least make sure they know what the candidates are about, I would say.
Christopher, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Christopher Olivola. He's assistant professor of marketing at Carnegie Mellon University.
We all work hard, so we all deserve a big raise, right?
But actually asking your boss for that raise can be an intimidating task, and many of us aren't that comfortable doing it.
Today we'll look at some ways to prepare so you can approach this tricky conversation with a little more confidence. Right now we're joined by Larry Schwimmer. He's the author of How to Ask for a Raise Without Getting Fired. Larry, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, I think probably the first hurdle for a lot of people is working up the nerve to ask for a raise and have that difficult, awkward conversation. How do you psych yourself up?
Well, I think the first thing that one can do is to basically write down all the achievements, all the ways that you feel like you've made your company money, you made your boss look good, and get in touch with what it is that is your contribution. I think it's easy to kind of talk about all the things that you do and the times you stay late and all that, but when you sit down and you write down on a piece of paper the 10 or 20 or 30 things that you've done, even coming up with ideas as to how they quantify themselves into actually saving the company money, then you start feeling good about your contribution and start feeling like you deserve a raise.
And I think a lot of us might think there's some, you know, behind-the-scenes scientific formula about what we get paid. You write that you've been on the other side, on committees working out who gets what raise, and it's surprisingly arbitrary, it sounds like.
You know, it really is. I call it the game of the raise, and I think a lot of people don't understand, especially maybe newer workers to the workforce, they don't understand that there's a great deal of subjectivity. As you get into most positions in growing in the corporate ladder, there is a salary range for a position, and often people will read, depending on your experience, the position may call for you're making between $36,000 and $42,000. Well, that $6,000 variance between the low end and the high end of the range is really subjective. So it's easy to negotiate if you know some of the rules. I try to counsel people that you can employ so that you get the mid end or the higher end of the range instead of getting started at the lower end of the range.
So we know some of the why and how to get psyched up for it. Now, how about timing? When is a good time to go to the boss, ask for that raise?
Anytime you've done something fabulous, anytime you save money, anytime you come up with a brand new idea, anytime that your star is shine at the job that you're in, is a good time to be able to begin to bring up the discussion that you would like to talk about the possibility of getting a raise or even some sort of bonus Or a third thing that many people don't think about is a perk, some sort of perquisite that they might be in a position to ask for. It could be anything like a company parking spot. It could be the use of tickets to the special owner's box for a ball game. There's just many little benefits you can ask beyond just even a simple raise.
All right, so we've made the decision. We've asked to meet with the boss. What do we lead with in asking for a raise?
Well, you know, it really has to start with some preparation. I think many people walk into the boss's meeting to discuss a raise, and they're not prepared. So the first thing is to make sure you get a sense of, through research maybe, Googling or whatever, what do people in your position make at other companies, or especially among competitors? There's a lot of places today you can go to get that information so you're informed. It can give you the ammunition you need to be able to sit down with a notebook and sit down with that meeting and be kind of rehearsed. So once you've done that research to understand what people in your position are paid typically, especially if you're a woman, and women today are still making, I think, 85 cents for every dollar a man makes, then you can sit down and talk to the boss about why you'd like a raise and some of the things you're thinking about in considering your future and staying with the company. And that's where the game of the raise begins to take shape.
Now, planning your future, whether you stay with the company, do you lead with meet my demands or I walk?
No, that's the aggressive approach, and those are the people who get fired. But the people who are not assertive are the ones, of course, at the other extreme, who are indirect and, you know, are constantly telling their friends and their family members how they're being taken advantage of. But the assertive people, the people that I'm referring to, are much more honest and direct in the way they approach the manager. They understand, and this is part of the game of the raise, Rob, that even a stupid manager knows that the high costs of training and replacing you usually far outweighs the amount of money that you're asking for in terms of the raise. And yet most people don't stop to, you know, to think that that's really a reality, isn't it?
Now, as you're talking, I'm thinking some of the preparation you mentioned a minute ago sounds a little like the preparation that you hopefully do when you apply for the job in the first place. Are you doing something comparable, listing out your skills, your benefits to the workplace, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. There's a great deal of commonality between the way you should interview for a job to get the highest amount of money that the position calls for and when you're looking for a raise. But there is a big difference. I tell people, here's some simple guidelines when you get into that raise discussion in the boss's office. Of course, always blow your horn when you do well. Compile a list of projects and accomplishments that you can take into your salary review. You may even want to send your boss a written copy just before your scheduled meeting to let that individual understand that you're really excited and enthusiastic about the company and what you've been able to accomplish. So that is the tone of the letter. It's not one of, you know, I want to talk to you about a raise because look at all the things I've done. Also make sure before the review that the boss knows you know, the kind of thing that you would expect for a raise, casually mentioning, maybe by exaggerating it, 50% more than, I've seen people walk in a water cooler and say to their boss, you know, I'm looking forward to our meeting this Friday. A $15,000, $20,000 a year raise would sure be good. And, of course, they both laugh. But they're putting it into the boss's mind that they're looking for a more substantial raise. Also, let the boss know what you might consider an insult. I've seen individuals who've taken my counsel say to the boss, looking forward to our meeting this week. I heard Joe so-and-so got literally a $5,000 raise, boy, that seems like a real insult. When I consider my performance, I'm sure looking for a lot more than that. These are all ways of letting the boss know where you're at.
Now, I imagine a lot of people would be reluctant and fearing the right away answer, something along the lines of, there's no way we can't afford it, or you're lucky to have a job in the first place, or something like a very flat no to start with. What happens when you get that no and close the door on your way out kind of response?
Well, the key, of course, is that the response that I counsel people in those negotiations always is predicated on them being a top performer. So with that in mind, obviously, if you're somebody that leaves work at 4:30 sharp, never wants to stay late, never wants to come in early, you know, what I'm going to say is not going to apply to you. But if you're somebody that goes the extra mile, who works extremely hard, who produces great results, you know, often the individual who's kind of the boss's right-hand person, if you're that kind of person, you should never accept those kinds of statements. So the reply to the boss that has said things like, well, there's no money in the budget, I'd love to pay you more money, you know, you're lucky to have a job, or those kinds of things. The reply that you give to that manager or that boss is to be able to say, well, look, you know, I love working with you, and I certainly love the company, but, you know, I need to be paid based on my performance. And, you know, if you're telling me that there's no other opportunity to make more money here, you know, and you think that I should be looking at other opportunities outside the company, please feel free to tell me that. And that would leave open the discussion in a very non-threatening way for the manager to say anything from, yeah, that's what I'm telling you, and therefore that's good information to know, isn't it? Or, wait a second, I didn't realize you were that, you know, you felt that strongly about it.
And can you keep the lines of communication open in that instance? Well, let's check it in 3 months and see if that's a better time?
Yeah, you certainly can. I think the key thing in that discussion is to get a real open, honest discussion about really what's possible. You know, the manager that is just stringing you along with promises that will never be fulfilled is one kind of manager. If you hear that, then you have to just ask yourself, do you want to continue working there? The manager that says to you more forthrightly, look, you deserve a raise. I'd like to give you one, but the budget approval for more money is not going to come till March of 2015. Would you be willing to hang in there? And I promise you we can get you a raise. That's a different type of approach. So I caution people to just be realistic. Don't be a victim. Don't be a martyr. Find out the truth. And if the truth is you're not going to be paid any more money, then know it. And make a decision if you want to make a change.
All right, Larry, thanks for joining us. That was Larry Schwimmer, author of How to Ask for a Raise Without Getting Fired.